Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm John Harwood of CNBC, and this is On Point. Debate about President Donald Trump often focuses on his personality. But what about the structures that made his election possible and that may be changed by his presidency? That's the subject of David Frum's latest book, Trumpocracy: The Corruption of the American Republic. The book is a study of Trump's rise to the country's highest office and what it means for American institutions. This hour on Point, President Trump. How did we get here and where do we go now? Joining me now from New York is David Frum. He's the senior editor at The Atlantic and a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. His new book is Trumpocracy: The Corruption of the American Republic, and it goes on sale today. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David, welcome to On Point.
John, thank you.
Let me start by asking you to summarize, for those who have not yet bought and consumed your book, your principal argument about how Trump got there and what he's doing to change American democracy, if he is.
Trumpocracy is a study of power, not a study of one man. And an American president, as powerful as he is, does not govern by himself. So that is the story. Why did other people go along with this? The Constitution, the whole American political system exists to screen people like Donald Trump out of power. You know, in 2015, the Republican Party voters were signaling as frantically as they could that what they wanted was better health care, less immigration, and no more Bushes. And the party converged instead on offering them less health care, more immigration, and one more Bush. You had 16 people on that stage saying the same thing, one person saying something different. Into the gap between where the Republican Party was and where its leadership was stepped Donald Trump. And he then leveraged his control over party, bending the party to his will, bending even Fox News to his will. He leveraged that control to gain control over the whole political system.
And did that happen because of the radical disjunction between where Republican votes come from and where Republican policy and doctrine comes from?
That was step one. You know, I talk a lot in the book about what Republican voters wanted. They do not want what Paul Ryan was offering, but that's what they were pressed upon them. Donald Trump arose in the first place as a candidate who is connected more to the real troubles of Republican voters. The terrible epidemic of drug addiction, stagnating wages, the shock and dislocation of mass immigration. So he gained the party, and because of the way the American political system works, once you have control of the party, you can then take control of the rest of the government. Donald Trump made a bargain with people like Paul Ryan. Donald Trump doesn't care about policy. He doesn't care about what the tax system is really. He can talk about it. He doesn't care. He traded Republicans the Republican leaders, their policy preferences, if they would protect him from his own wrongdoing, and especially if they would join with him in shutting down an investigation into the Russia attack on American democracy.
Do you buy the idea that Michael Wolff advanced in his book that Trump not only didn't expect to win the election but didn't want to win the election? Because one of the questions that arises for me is, if the bargain is you get your policy and you protect me from wrongdoing, you wonder why a president would emerge on the public stage like he did in the first place.
Look, like every journalist in Washington, I was enthralled by the Wolff book. But I think Michael Wolff systematically asks the wrong questions and produces unhelpful answers. Did Donald Trump want to be president? That's the wrong question, because you can't understand Donald Trump unless you understand that people like him are rising to power in all the democratic countries. We have a global crisis of democracy. It takes different forms in the United States than the forms that it's taken in France or in Austria or in Poland or in Hungary or in Turkey. But it's the same challenge everywhere. And so when this phrase Trumpocracy, it's a way of making people understand that we came of age, many of us, in a world in which from between 1990 and 2005, it looked like democracy was on the march. The world was becoming freer. More countries were having elections. Democracy was coming to places that had never had it before, East Asia and parts of Latin America. And since 2005, it has been on the retreat. Since 2015, it's been fast retreating. And a disease that seemed once confined to the semi-developed countries has leapt from the Polands and the Hungaries into the Frances and the United States.
But before I explore that idea, let me go back to the second part of your book, that is the part that occurs after Donald Trump has attained the presidency. You believe, as I understand it, that he's doing harm to American institutions that we have come to take for granted. Explain what you mean by that.
Both by intention and by mistake, Donald Trump has broken the central coordinating institutions of the United States government. The United States government is a giant bureaucracy full of pieces, all of which can operate on their own for a long time, the Department of Defense, the Department of State. But at the center, there are bodies that make these groups work together, like the National Security Council or the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Trump wrecks those. He does it sometimes on purpose, the way he's done with the NSC, which he's filled with people who shouldn't even be in the building, much less as visitors, much less staffers at the NSC. He put Steve Bannon on the NSC Principals Committee and excluded the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His son-in-law is still on the NSC Principals Committee. That's the central body for making the foreign policy of the United States. He has systematically attacked the Department of Justice. He has so much to worry about. He cannot afford to allow ordinary procedures of law enforcement to go forward. He's attacking the FBI, trying to discredit it. And he is inciting those agencies to defend themselves in ways that are also destructive. They leak things that should – under a normal president would never have been leaked. So one of the things I worry about a lot in the book is what I'm calling the autoimmune responses of government. I'll give you a very practical example. The reason Michael Flynn is not National Security Advisor anymore, I think a lot of people welcome, is because he was given the lie by the leak of his transcript of his conversation with the Russian ambassador, Sergei Kislyak. Sergei Kislyak, when he had that conversation, presumably thought he was on a secure means of communication. Now he knows that that means of communication is not secure. He will never use it again. That was a secret that was burned and had to be burned in order to give the lie to this dangerous person who wanted to be National Security Advisor.
Now, let me ask you about a recent piece by someone we both know, your fellow right-of-center intellectual and writer, David Brooks, wrote a piece in the New York Times. He said, in the wake of the Wolf book and the discussion of whether or not President Trump was mentally fit to serve in office, he said that the anti-Trump movement had devolved into hysteria that was discrediting it, and that, in fact, we are seeing a Donald Trump who is a more normal president than he has been portrayed so far. What do you say to David Brooks's argument?
Well, with the greatest respect to David, a friend, someone who's influenced me over the years and I admire and depend on his work, obviously it's always possible to overstate anything. But the risks of understatement, it seems to me, are even greater. Donald Trump is not a normal president. I wrote a piece in The Atlantic to respond to these kinds of arguments, which we're hearing more and more. And I said the unacceptable doesn't become acceptable if it's accepted in increments. But this is the thing that those of us who are concerned about it are precisely worried about this reaction from the David Brookses, where we're losing so much sight. Have you ever visited the Grand Canyon?
I have.
Walked down those steps toward the Colorado River. You take a casual little walk. You stroll for 10, 12 minutes. And suddenly, oh my God, you're 120 feet below the level right. of the ground. And you face this steep hike up. That's where we are. We've been walking gently. It seemed like a very casual stroll. And only if you look up do you see how far you've sunk.
Well, let me use that as a moment to play a piece of sound that occurred after the tax bill was enacted, as the stock market was booming, as it's booming to this very day. House Speaker Paul Ryan praised President Trump for his role in getting that tax bill across the line.
Something this big, something this generational, something this profound could not have been done without exquisite presidential leadership.
exquisite presidential leadership. What do you react to that?
Well, here's the test for people who share my politics. I, by and large, like most of the elements of this tax bill, especially on the corporate side. I think a 21% corporate tax rate makes a lot more sense than a 35% corporate tax rate. How much do I want that? I don't want it so much that I will break the constitutional system of the United States. And that's the kind of the moral test that Donald Trump presents to all of us. How much do you want these things? Paul Ryan, this thing you want, you can have it. But there is a terrible price to pay. And Ryan and his party have been paying it. So I hear that. And I think those are people who love their politics too much and their constitution not enough.
Have you ever talked to Paul Ryan about this subject?
About this subject? No. No. And I don't think you can. He wouldn't – look, Paul – he doesn't answer to me. He answers to a committee of shadowy billionaires. He's not – you can't – and maybe he's even over the years lost the capacity – so ideological – lost the capacity even to understand what he's doing. But he believes – he is – I'm convinced he's a man of ideals. Unlike Mitch McConnell, who – you know, is not. And Mitch McConnell's a man of power. Ryan is a man of ideals. But his ideals are leading him, as they've often led people, into a direction of fanaticism where you lose sight of more basic principles. The whole point to a constitutional system is that there are some things you do not do, that there are some ways of exercising power, even if the goals seem desirable, that are illegitimate. We're all committed to the rules even more than the outcomes of the game. That's the way it's supposed to be.
We'll come right back with David Brooks. We're talking to the author of Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Public. It goes on sale today. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
Hey, it's Maria Hinojosa, host of NPR's Latino USA, the podcast that takes you inside the Latino conversation. Each week, we'll take you into one story that will fascinate and often surprise you. Listen to Latino USA on the NPR One app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking to David Frum, a senior editor at The Atlantic and a former speechwriter for President George W. Bush. His book, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic, comes out today. I want to go to the phones right now. Martin is calling on the line from Fleming, Georgia. Martin, go right ahead. Welcome to the show.
Hi, John. I'm very pleased that someone from the left is allowing this kind of discussion. Usually, talk shows don't work on that side of the political spectrum. And I would like to say that I feel 180 degrees differently about Donald Trump from your guest. Your guest is certainly firmly a part of the establishment. And again, he doesn't realize the force of emotion that is behind the Trump election. And when you criticize Trump, you are not just criticizing Trump. You are criticizing us who voted for him. And, you know, personally, I'm a physician, okay? I'm a graduate of Columbia University and Case Western Medical School. And I feel I have fought all my life against an ossified, inflexible, biased leftist establishment, okay? And it started at the university. It went right on to the medical school, and it persists to this day. I am glad that the left is beginning to listen, but the resistance is immense. And you don't seem willing to give Donald Trump a chance. And I feel my personal opinion is he's a great president. It's and that in the future, history will look on those who oppose him as in a negative way, because the progress by then will have been evident. The things that he has achieved will have shown their effectiveness, and the tax cut is the beginning of that.
Martin, thanks so much for your call. David, how do you respond to Martin?
Well, I'll respond in a few ways. The first is the book's just out today, so obviously it's not possible for him to have read it. But if he were to do that, I hope he will, he would see I do spend a lot of time talking about the social forces that produced Donald Trump, the trauma of drug addiction, the fact that over the past decade or a little more than a decade, that for white Americans, life expectancy has gone down, something that didn't happen during the Great Depression, something that has never happened in peacetime to an advanced country ever. And the only comparable collapse of life expectancy is in post-Soviet Russia and Ukraine. I talk about the shock of and trauma of very high levels of immigration at a time of stagnant wages and slow economic growth. So I'm aware and I pay a lot of attention to where the support for Donald Trump comes from. But when the caller says I'm a member of the establishment, I don't know that that word – what he means by that word, I don't know that that word at this point in American history means anything. I mean, it is I just find it, I mean, you can watch Fox News every night and see people who make 10-figure salaries and never fly commercial denouncing the composing room at the New York Times as the American establishment. I don't think that that's a good description. But if it means that I am somebody who feels America is basically a success and that we have more to defend and that radical changes are to be avoided, yeah, I believe all those things. I want to defend the country as it was, and I think Donald Trump is on the attack. There are no achievements because Donald Trump doesn't want to do anything. He is about power. He is about self-enrichment, and he comes to office trailing this train of guilty secrets behind him that he has to shut down the national security and the law enforcement apparatus of the United States to protect.
David, I want to play a clip from Jeff Flake, senator from Arizona, who is going to give a speech tomorrow in the Senate floor where he makes some of the points that he foreshadowed in an interview with CNN yesterday. He spoke out against President Trump's habitual attacks on the media.
What concerns me is when you use phrases like enemy of the people, then that you trace that phrase back, and it was not a good origin. Really, it was popularized by Joseph Stalin. And I am in no way comparing President Trump to Joseph Stalin. Joseph Stalin was a killer. Our president is not. But it just puzzles me as to why you would use a phrase that is so loaded and that has such deeper meaning, the press being the enemy of the people.
David, is Jeff Flake the sign of rising Republican resistance to President Trump, or one of a tiny number of outliers who are leaving the Congress?
Unfortunately, he is not a sign of rising Republican resistance to Trump. Indeed, on the contrary, the more isolated Trump becomes within the American political system, the more the Republican Party will cling to him. It takes the House, the Senate, and the president to sign and to pass and sign a tax cut into law, but it takes only a president to defend that tax cut once the tax cut is passed. So Republicans very likely after November of 2018 will see in Donald Trump their only bulwark or their best bulwark against a Democratic Party that is full of energy, that has moved to the left, and that is focused often on Donald Trump's strong points, the points where he is most united with his own party. So I think you see the party rallying to him. I want to say one more thing about Jeff Flake, and I don't want to make any assumptions that the NPR audience bends toward the more liberal side, but let me make that assumption even if it's unfair and say to those who are on the liberal side, here's something to think about. One of the criticisms you often hear of Jeff Flake from people on the left is, well, he criticizes Donald Trump and yet he votes to confirm Donald Trump's judges. He voted in favor of the tax cuts. And I'd ask you to imagine that that this trend toward illiberalism in the United States had arisen on the left, not on the right. And that could have happened, and it happens in many European countries. And the United States was now confronting some Jeremy Corbyn-like president, somebody with ties to Hamas and Hezbollah, somebody who apologized for terrorist groups, somebody who was surrounded by people who were literal Stalinists and who had no sympathy for democratic decision-making. And against that president, a number of brave and conscientious and principled liberals said, I'm not with him. I'm going to oppose when this illiberal leftist does illiberal left things, I will speak up against them. If people on the right said to you, well, wait a moment, you haven't signed up for school choice. You're not in favor of cutting the capital gains tax. You're not opposing President Corbyn. I didn't say I'm surrendering my politics when I defended the Constitution. What Trump calls on us to do, the citizenship test he's posing to us, is we need to keep alive the possibility of democratic difference against a president who doesn't accept it. And the point is not to abolish
and
our differences.
And at a moment where that feels like an abstraction to so many people.
But it does feel – that's what this is all about, that what we have always felt before – we all have politics. But we all count that when there's a president who does not share my politics, my rights are still safe. I can still speak. The laws will still work. The courts will still be fair. That's what Donald Trump is challenging. When he calls the press the enemies of the people, I don't think anybody in media fears that they're going to be arrested or that there's going to be state repression against the media. But what everyone in media has noted is that Donald Trump incites levels of threat and violence from private actors outside politics. And those are just as intimidating, especially for women in journalism. And we saw that very intensely in 2016. It's abated a little bit in 2017. But all of us who speak out are aware, we all think about our safety in ways that people who criticized President Obama never had to think about their safety, or people who criticized President George W. Bush, that there would be some private actor who would, at the president's instigation, do something to harm you or your family.
I want to go back because young people, millennials who are aware of David Frum might think that David Frum is not only part of the establishment, he's part of the liberal establishment. But you've got a pedigree in conservative politics, and I want to play a clip that demonstrates that. In his 2002 State of the Union address, President George W. Bush named a number of countries that he called part of an axis of evil, and that is a phrase that David Frum came up with. Let's take a listen.
States like these and their terrorist allies constitute an axis of evil, arming to threaten the peace of the world. By seeking weapons of mass destruction, these regimes pose a grave and growing danger. They could provide these arms to terrorists, giving them the means to match their hatred. They could attack our allies or attempt to blackmail the United States. In any of these cases, the price of indifference would be catastrophic.
Now, David, as you recall, there were people on the left who thought that President George W. Bush had become anti-democratic in some of the things that he did. And some on the right said the same thing about President Obama, the way he used executive authority. Is there a direct line from either past Republican administrations to now or past administrations of both parties to what we see with President Trump?
I think the United States system of government is like a man falling downstairs, and at each stair, it looks like you've fallen as low as you can go, and then bump, 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 there's another stair. I think with the end of the Cold War, we began to play the political game inside the United States in a much more ruthless way than had been played before. And we saw a loss of feeling between the parties. They had shared ideals. The generation
Was that because of the distance from the shared experience of World War II? And the ideological sorting between the parties, or from some other cause?
I think this will be a great topic. The distance from World War II was a part. I think the fading of the danger from the Soviet Union, where senior members of Congress always understood that whatever their differences between each other, that there was this great common enterprise of defending the United States against the Soviet Union. The imminence of the nuclear threat, that And then the weaker sorting between the parties. But since 1990, the game's gotten more radical, and it's been getting more and more radical at each time. I opened the book with stories from both the Bush and the Obama era of how rules that had always been there were being broken. For example, while Supreme Court battles have always been very controversial, there was an understanding that appellate court battles, there was a limit to what you could do. In the Bush administration, for the first time, there was a filibuster of an appellate court nomination. The Democratic Party filibustered, I think, a dozen Bush appellate court judges. And then when President Obama was there, the Republicans took their revenge by doing it the same thing on an even bigger scale. So the system has been heading into trouble for a long time. Donald Trump didn't come out of nowhere. But the mere fact that these things have histories doesn't mean that what's happening today isn't different and more dangerous than what happened before.
I want to go back to the phones. We've got Vince on the line from Elm Grove, Wisconsin. Vince, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Thanks. I'm an historian, and I think we need a sense of where we've come from. We're the oldest democracy in the Western world, about 240 years, but we have all the problems of being the oldest. And after this country was founded, England began to continue to change to the point where its constitution, of course, the head of state, continued to be the king or queen, but they were more and more a figurehead. And the same is true in other countries today. My point is that we need some sort of a constitutional convention. We need to recognize the fact that this instrument is only as good as it is able to serve the needs of this country. If you've ever been to the National Archives in Washington, the documents, six pieces of parchment, are almost treated like holy writ, which is ridiculous. Yes, it's an important document, but it's not a... We need to re-examine the document, and I think we need to look at the rest of the developed world, all of whom have parliamentary systems of government, where you have a head of state. In the case of Canada, and I've lived outside this country for 20 years, Canada has the Queen as the head of state. That's why you have the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, you have the Royal this, the Royal that. They're the head of state, they're the commander-in-chiefs. And then you have the head of government, who's a prime minister. The prime minister has to be a member of parliament. They have to be able to convince their party that they have the ability to win an election. And therefore, they have to first and foremost be a politician. And under this type of system of government, and every other, as I said, developed country in the world has not adopted our system. The system that we have is developed, you know, in banana republics, where the president is the sole head of state and head of government. We need to separate this. We need to look at our Constitution again. And yes, it's a wonderful document. And yes, the First Amendment, for example, there are parts of it that are wonderful, but there are parts of it that need to be looked upon. And the main one is that we need a parliamentary, as I've explained, a head of, you know, keep the president, the White House, and all that as head of state, similar to the Queen in Canada, but then have, and obviously they'd be elected, but then you have a prime minister who's head of government, and this keeps the system honest.
Vince, you've raised a fascinating point, and you've raised it with the right guy, because David Frum himself is Canadian. David, what do you think of Vince's point?
Authoritarian populism is on the rise in parliamentary countries too. Austria is a parliamentary democracy. Hungary is a parliamentary democracy. France is a mixed system, but the National Front has done strongly in French parliamentary elections. In the Netherlands, a very strong parliamentary system with proportional representation. Authoritarian populist party is now the second biggest party in the Dutch parliament, and so across the continent. The American presidency as we know it is, although the Constitution is very old, the American presidency as we know it is really quite a new institution. The presidency as we know it was built in response to the nuclear era. Institutions like the National Security Council, they all exist because once the Soviets tested an atomic bomb in 1949, the United States was faced with the possibility of an annihilating attack that could come within hours and then later within minutes. And there wasn't time to convene Congress and get a declaration of war. That's one of the things I say when people say, just get Donald Trump out of your head. Don't think about him so much. You know, you think about him too much. I say, Donald Trump, the man, the only man on earth with the power to end organized human civilization and to do it within a quarter of an hour. That guy, I'm thinking about him too much.
Does that mean that you do not expect the American presidency and American institutions to snap back to something like normal when he leaves the presidency, whenever that is?
I do not. It will be the work of a generation to get them back to normal. Because one of the things Donald Trump has done is he's discovered a lot of the things were never written down. They're not laws. They're just habits. Those habits are broken. And once broken, they're hard to put together.
Norms are very difficult to sustain when they're broken. You're right. We're talking to David Frum about his new book, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Public. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.
Hello, just dropping in to remind you about Here and Now. We cover the day's most essential news with context so you know the why and what's next. A fast-paced snapshot of the world every day. Listen to Here and Now on NPR One or wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood. We're talking to David Frum, a senior editor at The Atlantic and former presidential speechwriter for George W. Bush. His new book, Trumpocracy, The Corruption of the American Republic, is out today. I want to go back to the phones. Nathan is on the line from Charlottesville, Virginia. Nathan, welcome to On Point. And what's your question for David Frum?
Hi, John. Thanks. And, David, thank you for coming on. It's nice to hear from principled conservatives. My own politics are well to the left of yours, but I think we share a disdain for rise of authoritarianism that we see with Trump. And I wanted to bring in the issue of inequality and deepening inequality. Over a generation, movement conservatism has really pushed for a concentration of wealth into very few hands. And I think that around the world has also attended with an erosion of democratic institutions. And so, you know, to me, stronger social democratic institutions like a social safety net, like universal health care, things that flatten slightly more or even a lot more the wealth distribution of the United States and other Western democracies would make democracy stronger. And as we see that concentration of wealth and power in just a few hands, that's what's giving rise to Trump. And of course, Trump is making it happen more to the point now where he is that Trumpocracy and sort of like power laid bare is sort of the modern GOP's MO to the point that it's kind of becoming the party of I got mine, Jack, and now I'm going to take more, too.
Nathan, I want to turn to David. David, that's an interesting point. Nathan's suggesting a contradiction for you as well in that if, in fact, rising inequality is part of the problem that's contributing to the things that you decry, that tax bill that you said you mostly liked, will that not deepen that trend?
I mostly like the corporate side of it. I don't like the individual side of it. I think that tax bill will. I've also been a proponent of a universal health care system as a way of cushioning some of the shock. I think a lot of the trend toward inequality is just the unavoidable consequence of China and India rejoining the global economy. What used to happen is we had substantial equality within countries, enormous inequality between countries. We've moved into a world where we have less inequality between countries and more inequality within countries. How do we cope
with
that?
And is there nothing to do about that? Steve Bannon has talked about a full-out sort of confrontation with China to try to change that situation. Is that possible?
Well, you can always deal with termites by burning down your own house, yes, and that will kill all the termites. It has some other side effects that might be less desirable. So my solution has always been – I agree with the caller that the United States needs a thicker social insurance network as a way of mitigating the effect of inequality that's coming anyway and health care being probably the most important part of it. But here's something I think it's worth – in order to sort of agree with him in part. The two developed countries that have been least susceptible to authoritarian populism are Canada and Australia. What do they have in common? I would point to three things. First, they were hit they had the fastest recovery from the crisis of 2008. Australia barely had a recession at all. Canada was returned very rapidly to pre-crisis levels of employment and output, did it within a year. So they didn't go through the trauma of the Great Recession the way the United States did in Great Britain or anything like the Euro crisis of 2010 that did so much damage in Europe. Second, if you rate the countries, if you take all the developed countries and break them into like groups of five according to their internal incomes, Canada and Australia had the best performing middle class of any of the developed countries. So they didn't get that concentration of wealth at the top and the concentration of poverty at the bottom that you see in the United States, Britain, and on the continent of Europe. And last, they both did a much better job of managing immigration. They actually still take quite a lot of immigrants, but they take them from many more countries. They take them at higher levels of skill, and they do a very good job of integrating them into the society so immigration doesn't become a dividing line between the within the country the way it is in the United States and Germany and Sweden and other places that have taken very large numbers of immigrants with very low skills from countries that are not so easy to assimilate. So I agree with the caller that these trends toward inequality are part of it. I would also challenge him to consider that mass immigration is everywhere a huge risk factor for authoritarian populism. And the Germany example here is really the most alarming because Germany – if we'd had this conversation in 2014, Germany would have been on the list with Canada and Australia as the most resistant. Then Germany opened its doors in 2015, took 1.2 million refugees from countries that don't accord well with the German way of life. There's been a huge upsurge in violence inside Germany. And in 2016, 2000, we see the rise of a far-right party in Germany. It wasn't there in 2014. It's now there. It's now a real contender for power in the eastern half of the country. So you have to get all of these things right.
I want to go back to an issue that you do discuss in your book, but we haven't discussed a lot this morning, and it has to do with what happened between Russia and the United States in the 2016 election, the interference. President Trump, in a press conference last May, after it had been decided that a special counsel would investigate Russia's cyber attacks during the 2016 campaign, he denied that there had been any collusion between Russia and his campaign.
I respect the move, but the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero. I think it divides the country. I think we have a very divided country because of that and many other things.
David, many people, I think, on the left have expressed the hope and confidence that the special counsel that President Trump was commenting on at that time, Robert Mueller, is in fact going to be the institutional check on this president. Are you confident of that?
No, for a number of reasons. First, what we already know, if the whole collusion story investigation stopped today, what we already know would be the greatest scandal of foreign interference in an American election in American history. It's just a fact that the Russians expended resources to help Donald Trump, that that help was welcomed by the Trump campaign, that there were meetings back and forth, and that that the Trump people seemed to have had some kind of contact. Some people in the Trump campaign had some kind of contact with WikiLeaks in advance of these dumps. That's all. Those are things that we now know. That's already – I will never get past any of that. There may be even worse things ahead, and in the book I give some evidence of reasons to believe that the cooperation went deeper than what I've just said. But it's very important to remember that while colluding – this we talk about norms. I've done a lot of work on this. While colluding with a foreign power, it raises the possibility of some technical infractions of election law. In itself, it's not illegal. It's not illegal for an American campaign to take information from a foreign government. That's not – if you steer clear of receiving things of value. But if you can avoid the technical infractions of election law, there's no crime. There's just a shocking, unpatriotic, un-American, undemocratic deviation from decency.
Which gets back to the norms that you talked about before that had been observed.
You know, in 2000, the Al Gore campaign received confidential information from – somebody leaked confidential information from inside the George W. Bush campaign. They returned it unopened. Now, maybe that's being excessively sporting. I don't know that George W. Bush would have done quite the same. But what I know about George W. Bush is had that information come from the Russians or the Chinese or the Iranians, they'd have been on the phone to the FBI. That's just the rule of the game because you should love your country more than you hate your political opponent. And that rule of the game has been broken and like so many other rules. I mean Donald Trump is today, right now, receiving millions of dollars of income. We don't know exactly how much from foreign business partners in the Philippines, in Turkey, in the United Arab Emirates. That's not disclosed. And all of those foreign partners, now they're private people, they're not governments, but they're all under the grip of governments. Donald Trump's former business partner, current business partner in the Philippines, is the present Filipino ambassador to the United States.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Kathleen on the line from Dayton, Ohio. Kathleen, welcome to On Point. What's your question?
Yes. I was a Sanders supporter, and I went to a Trump rally the summer of 2016 in Dayton, Ohio. I went with my sign that said, I'm a Sanders supporter, but I want to talk. I talked with many, many people going into the Trump rally, and many of them were former GM workers, Delphi workers, and I asked why, you know, what many of us hear, that they supported Trump based on that he was going to focus on bad trade deals and creating more jobs with higher wages. And many of them actually agreed with many of the things that Senator Sanders was saying. So, you know, Trump defines those people as the forgotten men and women. So I want to ask David Frum about how he thinks Trump has hurt or helped them. And I want to also ask David, I followed the, upcoming, the propaganda prior to the invasion of Iraq rather closely. And David, I want to ask why I should trust what you say when it comes to the corruption of American, the American Republic, when I believe that you helped corrupt that system by promoting that invasion that was against it. There was no declaration of war. So why should I trust you?
Kathleen, thanks so much for your call. David, go right ahead.
Well, first, there was an authorization to use military force against Iraq, and John Kerry and Hillary Clinton voted for it, among many other Democrats. But I'm not asking you to trust me. I don't think you should trust people. If you open the book, you will see footnotes that with links to thousands of pieces of reporting. One of the things I did, sort of a salute to the outstanding work done by my colleagues in the press. I mean, the normal convention when you cite work is you'll say an article that appeared in the New York Times or an article that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. I make a point of, in every one of those cases, unless there are five bylines on the story, listing the authors so that they get due credit, but also you understand where every claim in this book came from. One of the challenges of the Trump years is actually there have been more scandals than the human mind can retain, and every day a new one is unearthed, and so we dropped the last one. So one of the things I try to do is put together here a museum of what happened. I don't ask you to if you don't take my word for it. Well, that's how we got into this mess in the first place. Don't take people's words for it. Be a better. If you are personalizing your news feeds according to what you think of the person telling them, you're doing it wrong. We all need to be – and one of the – at the end of the book with some reasons for hope but also some obligations we have, how to be better citizens. And one of them is to be better news consumers. Another obligation is to remember if you own a smartphone – and just about every American does – you hold in your pocket more broadcasting power than Walter Cronkite ever commanded. Use that power responsibly. When you be careful what you forward. Don't put things on Facebook or in your Twitter feed unless you've clicked the link, you see where the information comes from, and it's somewhere responsible. You use your own power properly.
Let's go back to the phones. Nick is on the line from Salisbury, Maryland. Nick, welcome to the show. Go right ahead.
Hi, John. Just briefly, I just wanted to say I think you're in dangerous ground, the author there, in trying to change our American system and just throw a wrench in the works. We have mechanisms in place that are created to basically stop any of the things he's talking about. There's three branches of government that have worked so far. It's such a good system. I'm so thankful to be in the United States. It's such a great country. It's a great country. The other thing I wanted to tell you is he going to apologize for comparing the American foreign government to a banana republic? And I'll take my answers off the way. Thanks.
Thanks, Nick. David?
I can't apologize for what I didn't say. What I have said is that what the forces that are pushing the United States in an authoritarian direction are true throughout the developed world. I would never use the phrase banana. I have great respect for the democratic development in Central America, which is where that phrase originated. I wouldn't use that term. I might quote somebody using it, but I wouldn't use it myself. But I would not be as confident as the caller that the United States is immune to the pressures that happen to other countries. And many of the things that Donald Trump is doing, there is no check. There is no balance. It is not illegal for the president's family to use access to the president to make mega million-dollar business deals. It just didn't used to happen. It's not illegal for the president to continue to operate a business while in office. Just didn't used to happen. It's not illegal for the president to spend a third of his time vacationing on his own properties and charge the taxpayer via the Secret Service.
You do not believe that the fact that a very high percentage of people buying Trump Organization properties now, their identities have been hidden. You don't think that is a coincidence or accidental? You think that's purposeful?
I talk about this in the book. The most recent story is it goes beyond a story that appeared in USA Today that I cite in the book of the rise of it looks like there's a lot of money laundering inside the Trump enterprise. But the mere fact that people buy Trump properties through a shell company, it's suspicious. But it itself, it's not illegal. I remember when I started the article that led to the book, I sat down with a lot of veterans of White House counsel's office, Republican and Democrat, and I began going through possibilities. What law would stop this? And I remember one of them, somebody who served in the Obama administration, saying to me, "You have a really criminal mind. I would never have thought of any of this stuff." But once you think of it, you say, "Well, I guess I would say I just can't imagine a president doing it." But it's happening. A president is doing it.
David, do you think President Trump will serve 4 years, 8 years, or less than that?
Barring a health event, I assume he will serve 4 years. I can't imagine the 25th Amendment removal process going anywhere. It's hard for me to imagine him being impeached and removed without a real national consensus that just isn't there.
You don't think Bob Mueller's investigation is likely to produce such a consensus?
I think it's going to cause Republicans to rally around him even more tightly as he gets ever deeper into trouble.
David Frum's book, Trumpocracy: The Corruption of the American Public, comes out today. David, it was a pleasure talking with you today.
Thank you so much, John.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, a new generation of musicians reinvigorates the Appalachian ballad in a Grammy-nominated album. I'm John Harwood, and this is On Point.